Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with John Rawling, Ian Dark and myself, Tris Dixon. Gents, I mean, I think we always hope these fights live up to the hype. They rarely do. But Tyson Fury, Alexander Usyk, lived up to the hype and then some. John, agree?
Yeah, I think it was better than I expected. You know, I mean, as we said in the preview, I think we all expected it to be close, but we didn't expect a fight of the intensity that we witnessed. You know, the bravery from both guys, technical skill, yes, but will to win and pride was terrific. It was a very, very good heavyweight fight by any yardstick by which you choose to measure.
Ian, how excited were you during the momentum shifts as things went from one side to the other and all the rest of it? Were you out of your seat at all in any of it?
Yeah, I was on the edge of my seat, pretty excited. Yeah, it was a very good fight, high quality, two excellent technicians. I think we knew that going into it. And just like John said, I think it was probably a lot better than some people feared. They wondered if it might just develop into a bit of a chess match. Well, it was far from that. It had enough drama. It had some controversy on the scoring and one or two other things as well. So, yeah, put that one up as a bit of a modern classic.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've got to be a bit careful with hyperbole some of the time, but I think that this is one of the ones where you can really be forgiven for running away with it, because it just ticked so many boxes, didn't it? It was, you know, we didn't know which way it was going to go. And, you know, I think there were rounds there, I think between rounds 4 and 7, where it looked like Tyson had it in the bag, right, John?
Yeah, I thought Usyk started very well. I thought there was a very good argument that he took the first 3 rounds.
Yep.
Then Tyson came back strongly. He got his nose squashed, I think, in the 8th round, didn't he? And then there's the fabulous 9th round. And Usyk completely dominated down the stretch until you get to the last round, when probably with the fight lost by that stage, despite what his corner was telling him, Fury won that last round. And you kind of finished it thinking, well, what could have been? But, you know, he was fortunate to get through that 9th round, wasn't he? The referee,
yeah.
Had he crashed into that gatepost 30 seconds earlier, I don't think he'd have got through the round. And the referee giving him that 8 count, which, you know, I mean, it depends how you interpret it. If he was saved from hitting the floor by the rope, and it certainly looked that way to me, then the referee was right in giving it a count. It was a contentious point, and certainly one which I think probably saved Tyson Fury from being stopped.
Ian, what was your take?
I thought it was pretty actually. Yeah, you could argue that the ropes kept him up, but he really did Fury a big, big favour, stepping in, giving him plenty of recovery time. I mean, there's an argument for saying the way he was tottering around the ring, hardly knowing where he was, that the referee should have stopped the fight right there and then. Would there have been any argument if he'd stopped the fight? Probably they would have made one later on, but I don't think in the moment anybody would have thought that was the wrong decision. So he got away with something there. I think the fight went roughly there as John just described it. Usyk winning the first 3 rounds, Fury winning the next 3. You could argue about the 7th. I thought that Usyk won that personally, and the 8th, and the 9th, 10, 8th, and the 11th, and then Fury won the last. So how they came up with the split decision, I was shaking my heads when he said that. There was a very clear winner of the fight. You can argue about the margins, and thank God they got the right winner, but that was no split decision.
I've got to say that... That ninth round, by the way, I mean, talk about sporting drama. I mean, you know, it would have been nice if it was more level and not just Fury taking a shellacking, although there's probably people saying, shut up, Tris, we've been waiting for this for ages. But, I mean, it was high drama. And I watched the fight the first time live, and then I know a load of people who re-watched it, and I watched it again, I think, I want to say on Monday. And I was watching it with an eye to the stoppage. And Ian, really, I completely agree with what you said. And we've talked about bad stoppages on this podcast. And that wouldn't have been a bad stoppage. I made it that there were possibly, I think, three moments where the referee could have intervened and called it off. And there wouldn't have been a complaint because Tyson didn't know where he was. He didn't have his senses. He didn't know if he was coming or going. And I think he would have, he might have done the old put his hands up and protest, but through very vacant and empty eyes, because he was all at sea. And it was an amazing thing to see, isn't it? It's amazing to see a near 7 foot giant tottering around. We saw it briefly when Hay detonated on Valuev and his legs just stumbled a bit. But this was another few levels removed from that, with Fury really all at sea. And it was amazing, wasn't it? Because it was like someone chopping down a tree with a teaspoon, wasn't it? Because it didn't happen just from that one shot, did it? It was the culmination of him being pesky and annoying and persistent the entire fight, chipping and chipping and chipping away, right, John?
Yeah, and when he got the opportunity, didn't he take it wonderfully well? You know, it was Ian's already referred, we've both referred, all of us have referred to the technical ability of Usyk. And when the chance came, he just wasn't missing, was he? It was the accuracy as well as the power. Or, you know, had he been a bigger puncher, he might have put him away. But technically, the attack was superb. And he was literally one punch away from scoring an extraordinary knockout victory.
Yeah, I mean, had we got that, would there be so much interest in the rematch, which we'll get to? But in terms of the action and all the rest of it, I mean, Ian, do you have it up there with one of the great heavyweight fights of all time? When we look back, or when we're long gone, do you think people will say this was our, you know, God, our Bo Holyfield?
Yeah, I think they probably will. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was quite alongside Bo Holyfield, not quite there, but it was nearly there. And you can certainly put that down as a memorable fight that people will mention when they talk about the great heavyweight fights. Have been a lot worse, put it that way, haven't they? I mean, you weren't quite sure which way it was going to go. There was an ebb and flow. It looked for all the world. I mean, if you'd have asked me and stopped and froze the action at the end of round six, I would have said, the size difference is getting to Usyk now. He's been hurt by body punches. Fury looks very comfortable and in control, and he's probably going to stop Usyk in the next two or three rounds. That's how you'd have read it. So who would have thought that it turned around the way it did? Great credit to Usyk for that. And the words of Tony Bellew, I heard an interview with him ahead of the fight, of course, having fought Usyk. He said, when I fought him, he was much, much better even than when I'd watched the tape of him. I couldn't believe how much better he was, and the way he could always get himself in range because of his front foot, where he placed his front foot. And I saw that again in that fight. And he said, and the other thing is, once he senses that he's got you tired, he said, and I've never been as tired as when I fought him after about seven rounds of it. Once he's got you, he knows he's got you and presses home the advantage. And that kind of played out, didn't it, from the seventh round onwards in that fight? He kept landing with those left hooks.
Well, yeah. I mean, I spoke to Tony just before the fight for Boxing Scene, and he said the same thing about his levels of exhaustion. But he also said that he'd spoken to Anthony Joshua about this previously, and both of them said they've never been as exhausted as they are by Usyk. And it's because he puts you under such mental duress that you don't have a moment's respite. He stays just in enough range so that you can't switch off, and you need to stay concentrated and engaged the entire time. And I did think about that during the ninth round. I just thought, is Fury just exhausted by, you know, not really putting a dent in this guy, and the guy's still coming at him.
Yeah, I mean, he makes you fight, doesn't he, at the pace of a middleweight, almost. I mean, Fury kept trying to land a couple of punches, then went for a little walk before to re-engage. Usyk wasn't having that. He was right back on top of him, making him fight 3 minutes of every round. And, you know, for a big, big man like Fury, I think, you know, there were stories, I don't know whether they were rumors or stuff people put out ahead of the fight, that he'd said to the TV companies, you know, a few years ago, he didn't really want to be put in with smaller men. But I think Usyk's no smaller man, is he? He's grown into the heavyweight division, but he's got all the speed and technical ability of a top-class middleweight.
Yeah, John, I mean, in terms of the fight and how it went, I mean, credit, I suppose one thing, and I've not seen a lot on this, because obviously there's so many people allowing Usyk to share the spoils. But credit for Fury, for his heart and bravery. And one of the things I said to Matt Christie before the fight is, you know, if ever there's been a time for someone to feel exhausted and think, okay, you know, for the old Hagler analogy of silk pajamas, thinking I don't need this anymore, Fury not once did that. And as you alluded to, he came back, and whether I had him actually share in the 12th round, but either way, to come back from that catastrophic ninth. And in fact, I wrote this for Boxing Scene. I think how he came back and weathered the storm post the ninth round was just as impressive as his rise from the death against Wilder all those years ago.
Yeah, it was similar, wasn't it? And I saw an interview with Frank Warren, of course, who will trumpet his man's abilities, as he would do, wouldn't he, as his promoter. But he's spot on when he talks about the fighting heart of Tyson Fury. And that's what we were seeing there in the latter stages on Saturday in Riyadh. And it's what we saw those years ago in Los Angeles. You know, he is a man who does not take defeat lying down, literally. He will get up and give it everything. And he's got an astonishing desire to win. And yeah, you know, at the end of the day, the final analysis, and I think when he looks back and reflects on it and views it again, he'll probably agree that he did lose the fight. Because, you know, Tyson is not a stupid man. He sometimes says stupid things for whatever reason, but he's far from stupid as a man and as an analyst of the fight game. And he'll know that he was beaten on the day. But, you know, you look at Lennox Lewis losing to McCall, losing for the second time when he got done by Haseem Rahman. Look at Muhammad Ali losing to Frazier and to Ken Norton and to Leon Spinks. You know, the great fighters do get beaten. George Foreman came back from the defeat against Muhammad Ali, and 10 years later or whatever it was, he becomes world heavyweight champion again. I think the fact that Fury has lost doesn't necessarily mean to say that it's ruined his legacy. You know, were he to come back and win in the rematch in October, then that puts him in a strong place. He to a substantial extent, if he can win that, which I doubt, but if he can, there would be some sort of redemption there.
Well, the judge who mistakenly, and then he needs to look back at the tape again, who scored the fight for Fury, he's done the promoters a big favour, hasn't he? And then Fury's muddied the waters himself by saying, well, I thought I won the fight. So the rematch is definitely one they can sell and probably sell for more money. People will want to see what happens, whether Fury can find answers. But I wonder whether it's the same mistake he might be making as AJ made. I think AJ made a terrible mistake in signing for another fight with Usyk, who'd shown once that he clearly had too much for him. And as we used to joke, John, we've seen the fight, hadn't we? So, I mean, yeah, he did better AJ second time, but I don't think he's ever going to beat Usyk. And I wonder whether Fury is ever going to be able to beat Usyk as well. But I'll pay to watch it again.
Oh, yeah, so would I. I'd love to be there. I'd love to be commentating on it. But, you know, having seen the fight, and for the reason that you said there, Ian, I think there's a persuasive argument that if it does happen again, when it happens again, I think there's a good argument that Usyk would win more comfortably second time around.
which is what often happens, isn't it, with rematches. You get the same outcome, only a little bit more decisively. But, I mean, let's ask ourselves, Chris, what do you think? What could Fury do differently second time?
Well, that's a tough one, isn't it? Because the thing is, what's so good about Usyk is that whatever your strategy is, he can adapt and work things out and start working things out. So no matter how you set up Tyson, it will only be a matter of rounds before Usyk starts adapting and coming around to what's set out, to the problem set out in front of him. So I think that's the issue. But I suppose what you look at is, you know, you look at that period between rounds 4 and 7 and see what was the difference and why was Tyson so effective. And, you know, I hate to be that guy because, you know, Fury was, you know, when you talked about his dominance there, Ian, there was a lot of stuff he was doing really well. He was throwing a lot of double jabs and the right hand behind it, but he was varying the right hand nicely to the body, the head, and with uppercuts. But also, he was doing a bit of the old spoiling where he was leaning on Usyk, and maybe I would bring that into play a little bit earlier on, but I don't know. I'm not sure just how negative that is, and it would certainly stop it from being quite the spectacle. I would maybe try to get the uppercut into more play. And I think the problem is Fury whacks okay to the body, but he's not a Mike McCallum or a Mickey Ward style body puncher. So you could see there that, you know, he can crack to the body and have success, but he's not a guy who folds people in half to the body. So, you know, I'm not saying he'd have to ignore that. That's a good part of his strategy, and the variation would keep Usyk guessing. But it's very difficult to lay out a plan for Usyk, given that he will react to what you're doing, and you then need to have your own gears to realign your strategy to go with his adjustment. I've gone around there. That's a long way of me saying I haven't got a clue in.
He's not.
Well, I was thinking that as well, but I wondered if you might have. I'll tell you something. You raised something there. He's going to need a better trainer in the corner than they had. I mean, that corner was a mess, wasn't it? And the fight, you know, with Sugar Hill Stewart and then John Fury talking. I mean, exactly what you don't want in a top-level championship corner was that. I thought, you know, they were poor.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that cliche. You want one voice in the corner, but you do. And it's got to be a level head. And he was going back to a whole plethora of stuff of backslapping, of go out there and finish him, and some tactical stuff. And you don't need all that, surely.
No, it was fairly cringingly awful, the corner work, wasn't it? I mean, people saying John Fury was bad. Yeah, I don't think his voice should have been there at all, personally. But Tyson presumably wanted him there. And I don't think that what was coming from the other voices there, I didn't think Sugar Hill was particularly impressive either. There were so many mixed messages. And, you know, you need clarity of thought, don't you? You need somebody who's clearly the leading voice in there. And there was actually contradiction between the two of them, or the three of them, right the way through. And in the key rounds, when you wanted a clear head to be trying to tell him what to do, there were two or even three conflicting voices.
One of the worst corner advice before the last round. They needed to be telling him in pretty emphatic fashion he needed to go out there, throw punches and stop this guy. Otherwise, there's, you know, the decision's going against him. They kind of led him to believe that he had it in the bag, didn't they? It reminded me when we did Nigel Benn fighting Sugar Boy Malinga. I think it was in Newcastle. And Ben's behind in the fight and the corner are telling him, go out and keep him on the end of your jab in the last round. It was farcical, and he lost the fight. So I don't know. Like John said, it wasn't really clear what they were telling him, but there was certainly no sense of urgency sending him out for the last round.
I do wonder, John. I mean, like Ian said, as he questioned me, what could he do differently? Is there anything that you would do? I mean, obviously, when you look at Fury's fights with Wilder, he had three pretty different outlooks and stages, didn't he? He had the first one where he was quite defensive and quite twitchy and a lot of feints and tried to bring Wilder onto sharp counters. The second one, he went out and basically mauled him. And the third one was something of a halfway house, but just, you know, he ended up just getting involved in a tear up. Do you think there's one way for him to box, given his dimensions and experience, and what he would have learned from that fight?
The difference between Usyk and Wilder, of course, is that Wilder is hopelessly technically inadequate alongside Usyk. He might be able to punch like a donkey kicks, but his footwork is so bad that it enables him to get mauled around by the bigger man, who was Tyson Fury. And his lack of footwork and maybe overall conditioning played into Tyson's hands, because Tyson was able to hold him, pushing him around and get him onto the front foot, get him onto the back foot, where he was so, you know, virtually incapable of boxing, that it made it Fury's fight. I think that when they fight again, he's got to somehow find a way to dominate center ring. And he can't just do it for two or three rounds. He's got to do it from the outset. You know, in this fight on Saturday, he effectively gave Usyk the first three rounds by being slow off the mark and allowing Usyk, as we said in the preview, you let this guy get into a rhythm and you're in trouble. And he was into a rhythm in those first three rounds. He picked up the points. And by the time Fury started to rally, he was almost in the point where he had to absolutely dominate everything from there on in. So maybe second time around, they've got to find a way, one way or another, where Fury is quicker out of the blocks and is scoring meaningful punches and meaningful moves in the early stages of the fight and not allowing himself to get three rounds down. Because you get into that sort of position in any sort of very competitive battle as this was, and then you're always up against it. And I think that, you know, if they've convinced themselves that Fury wasn't two or three down in those first three rounds, I think that's delusional. I think they need to look at it objectively and say, yeah, we need to start better. We need to put our stamp on that fight from the word go. And that's what Fury didn't do.
He was quite arrogant, wasn't he? You had all that showboating going on. And I'm thinking, work. The judges are scoring this and you're not busy enough. He certainly wasn't busy enough in any of those first three rounds. So in any rematch, he's got to be busy. He's got to get center ring. He's got to establish his jab. He's got to lean on a bit more and make the size tell. And he's got to sustain that body attack more. I thought he had the body attack going through rounds 4 to 6, kind of called off the assault in that regard, I thought, as the fight went on. But maybe that was because Usyk had worked out some other angles and his judgment of distance was so good. And he came on very, very strong from about the end of the sixth round on. So maybe there was a bit of that in it. But, you know, that would be a sort of basic idea for Fury. But you need a top-class trainer and some top-class work. And he's got to be in tip-top shape mentally and physically to even have a hope of carrying that out. Because whatever he does, as I think you've both said already, Usyk is the kind of guy who can compute all that and come up with answers to whatever you do differently.
I think it might have been fatigue, Triz. You know, he was right back into it, and it seemed that the pendulum had swung, and then he couldn't sustain it. Now, if that might be the mark of a fighter who's aging and can't maintain his fitness through 12 rounds, I don't know. You know, time will tell. But he definitely had the edge and had the momentum after six. And for whatever reason, it just ebbed away worryingly quickly.
Hey, by the way, gents. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm just going to say, I don't think you can seriously question Fury's fitness and conditioning. Without being in tip-top shape, he wouldn't have got through that ninth round in the way.
Yeah, sure, I buy that. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
So, by the way, gents, did either of you see that slow motion Usyk left hand very early in the fight that they played back and again? And it might have even been in the first round where Usyk lands a big left over the top. Mm. It distorts Fury's face. And there's a note, and granted, obviously, if it was any one of us, we'd look like roadkill. But there was a look of real shock on Fury's face when it registered, as if to say, this guy's not the middleweight that I was planning on fighting.
Yeah. I did notice that. I thought exactly what you just said, Tris. That one registered on the Richter scale, didn't it? That shot. And he thought, yeah. Hello, what have you got here? And, you know, I think beyond about the halfway point in the fight, you got no more showboating from Fury. And he knew he was down in some very, very serious business.
Yeah, he was down in the deep waters by that point, wasn't he? Yeah. But yeah, it was fascinating. So in terms of what comes next, obviously we're told that there could be a rematch October the 12th. It's contracted, it's obligated, which means it's kind of mandated. Let's not go down the road of the IBF possibly stripping Usyk and all the rest of it after having waited 25 years for Undisputed and it's all gone in a puff of smoke in a couple of weeks. We'll gloss over that. But I mean, the rematch, is that the fight that you want, John? Or let me put some options on the table. They both walk off into the sunset, heads held high, a la Thriller in Manila, where perhaps Ali and Frazier should have gone. Usyk retires and Fury fights AJ. Usyk fights someone else in a bid to sort of clear out the division, like a Wilder, who he's not fought. He's probably the only one of the big names he's not fought, so he could effectively clear out the era and then retire. Or is it all about the rematch for you?
I don't see why. It's a little bit of a modern thing, isn't it, the instant rematch? You know, when Ali lost to Frazier, we didn't go straight into Ali Frazier 2 and then Ali Frazier 3. There were other fights between. And I honestly think in Fury's case, he'd make a lot of money from fighting other people. And if he can just get a bit of time before the rematch, which I think inevitably would happen at some point, he might be the better for it, could be a better fighter for it. Yeah, you know, the fact I would like to see a rematch, which I would, is neither here nor there. I think as Fury's manager stroke promoter, I think Frank will obviously be thinking, yeah, well, he's got another 80 million, 100 million or whatever from a rematch. And therefore, in business terms, it makes fantastic sense. But in the interests of his fighter, is it really the best thing for him to be jumping straight back in?
Well, I don't know. It's tough, isn't it? So I think here's the thing with that, John. There's a lot of contractually obligated rematches today. And generally, or not generally, but quite often, we don't even want the return. You know, one of the most famous ones has been Kambosos and Haney, where Haney outpointed Kambosos, but Kambosos got the rematch and the same thing happened. Tarver had one of those as well. I can't remember who that was with, but when you just have a, you know, you're literally selling this. And like you said, you've seen the fight and then the exact same thing replays. I think the thing is with this is one of those fights where, as Ian alluded to it, there has been a bit of controversy over the scorecards. You know, they've had a sort of feel out of each other. It was a thrilling fight. And so therefore you can make a case for an immediate rematch. It's not like one of those where, you know, stick it on ice and necessarily you need to revisit it. Plus they're at the stage of their careers where they might only have, you know, one or two or three more fights left each anyway, because while we know about Fury's high mileage, Usyk is a couple of years older at 37.
Yeah. Well, I think Usyk has got really not much more to prove, has he? At 37, he could walk away right now. I don't think he will. There's a stack of money to be made with a rematch. I think this is one of those cases, I hear everything John was saying there, but I think this is one of those cases where the instant rematch isn't really the worst idea, as long as there's a decent gap for both fighters to rest, recuperate, and then get themselves ready for a second fight. So I think the second Leonard Duran fight was quite quick after the first one, wasn't it?
Well, it was too quick for Duran, wasn't it? Duran had been out on the booze and got caught cold.
Well, Leonard fought the wrong fight, didn't he, in the first one in Montreal, and it was a completely different affair, the no mass one in New Orleans. So, but we digress, going back to another era there. No wonder we call it
stuck in the past.
Always going back, living in the past, like Jethro Tull. There's another dated reference for you. I can bear to watch it again, to be honest with you, on October the 12th.
Yeah. And in terms of legacy, John, that's something you already mentioned. Obviously, I know there's a ways to go and there's the rematch, but what has this done to Fury's legacy? Has it harmed it? The fact that, you know, he's not made it to Undisputed, that he's lost to a guy he's been calling a middleweight for the last several years. Has it been enhanced with his effort and his showing? What's it done for Fury's standing?
His standing has been damaged, no question about it, and he's a proud man. He obviously, by the way he approached the fights and those early round showboating, I think underlines it. He thought that he was going to go in there and just be too big, too good, and show himself as a general, genuine heavyweight against somebody who wasn't. So, to lose to somebody to whom you'd spoken in such demeaning terms in the build-up, I think will hurt him. And that's, I suppose, whether or not it's the right thing for him in career terms, that's why he will go back in there trying to rectify what happened. I'm convinced he'll take the fight. Whether he should be taking the fight is another matter. And one of the reasons he will take the fight is that he will want to underline his legacy. And by losing to the little gap-tooth middleweight, or whatever he's called him, that certainly undermines what he believed and what his promoters were saying was his position in the history of the sport. You know, Bob Arum saying he's the most marketable and impressive heavyweight since Muhammad Ali. Well, you know, I mean, personally, I think that's rubbish. I think that's just promoter speak. But Tyson's clearly had that in his ear, and he'll want to go out and prove himself.
It's whether he's got the ambition, the burning ambition still, the fire, the desire to go back and do it all again. I mean, yes, it has, I think, for the moment, damaged his legacy. But if at the end of his career, he can turn around and say, well, I beat Vladimir Klitschko, I beat Wilder in spectacular fashion, I beat AJ, if ever that comes to pass, and I beat Usyk. Whatever he says about Usyk, we all know Usyk is a great fighter. I think he's established that point pretty much beyond dispute. He did at the weekend. So if he can say at the end of his career, he comes back and beats Usyk in a rematch, then his legacy is still sky high. But at the moment, you can't really have him in the same conversation as, say, Lennox Lewis, if you're talking about greatest British fighters of all time, etc. No, that's on hold.
Yeah, I suppose that's a fair point. I mean, if he comes back and just say, for instance, for argument's sake, does a demolition job on Usyk, then that's next level, isn't it? That enhances his legacy.
Yeah, it's a big sell point, isn't it? And I'm sure Frank Warren will be pushing that line pretty hard as a because it's a good commercial line for the rematch, isn't it?
Hey, John, let me ask you this. You know, we talked a little bit just there about Fury and his personality and the hunger and desire. I'm sure you probably saw some of the pre-fight quotes that went around from his small national newspaper huddle pre-fight, where he was talking about the burden of fame and the recognition. And he was talking about how it's horrific. And I've spoken to him about this before, you know, and, you know, granted, we're not famous. But that brings me on to another question shortly, which I have for you guys. But if we were wanting to disguise ourselves and go out, we could put on a hat and a scarf and no one would know who we are. Not that anyone knows who we are anyway, but you know what I mean. But for Fury, who's a 7'20" giant, there's nowhere to hide. And he does get all this stuff where he's said in these pre-fight interviews, and we had it with Declan Warrington over a Boxing Scene. Really, really good stuff where he talks about, you know, he's at dinner with his family and people are hanging off his shoulder doing selfies with a camera and stuff. And he talked about the burden of fame. I suppose whether or not you've got the hunger or not, there might come that point where you just don't want the limelight anymore, John.
No, I think, you know, he's going to have that now to an extent for the rest of his life because of what he's done so far and the way he is. I think he does find it difficult, and some of his more outrageous outbursts maybe are because of his bipolar personality and the fact that he doesn't really have a filter or a cutoff between what's right and what's wrong. So if you get him in a certain mood and he thinks that something needs to be said, he'll say it. You know, and we're old enough to remember Mike Tyson, Ian. He was similarly, wasn't he? You know, at times, Mike Tyson could be fascinating, incisive, and a great student of the sport. But if you got him on the wrong day, you know, he was Tyson Fury times five. He could be a fairly frightening man when he was in the wrong mood. And I think, you know, Tyson's a little bit like that. And he does find fame a fairly difficult bedfellow. You know, he doesn't warm to it very naturally always, even though he plays the showman. I think when he's particularly when he's under pressure, and unquestionably in this fight, when it was in the run-up, there was a fear factor which would raise itself from time to time. And that's when Tyson was coming out with some of his more outrageous stuff, which we all saw as sound bites on social media.
Mm. I never had him down as any shy, modest introvert, though. I mean, you could quite easily say he rather enjoys the fame and the limelight. Well, I think he might have a problem later in life, as a lot of fighters and sports stars do, of coping without the fame when people don't recognize him anymore. That's a long way down the line. And the price of fame, well, yeah, you are going to get people bothering you. But, you know, when you're as famous as him, I think, you know, having $100 million in the bank from one fight is probably a pretty good way of getting around it. So I think my sympathy is limited, to be honest with you, because it's the world and the aura that he has created for himself, really. So, he wants to be a star. He is a star.
I suppose the thing is, if he didn't like it, he wouldn't be doing all the Netflix business and everything else as well. There is that. Bipolar thing's interesting, because, you know what, going back to my days at Boxing News, I reckon it was around about, possibly about 2011, actually. I'm not sure I've told this story to anyone before. We were short of a front cover star, and it was before Fury was Fury, back when he had a load of, you know, flowing black hair and all the rest of it. And we had a photographer from Manchester who'd supplied some great images of Fury. And I was like, well, look, I'll run one of them on the cover and I'll phone Fury up and interview him. And I phoned Fury up, and I think it was in the aftermath of the Nevin Pagic fight. And Pagic had put him over with a big right hand, I think, on Channel 5. And I spoke to Fury for what must have been about 15 minutes. And he was great. He was self-deprecating, modest. He said, Nevin Pagic's right hand was the lawnmower, my chin was the grass. And he all these lines. And I, because we were on deadline, I wrote it straight onto the page. Had it checked, edited, and gone, wallop. Fury phoned me about 2 hours later and said, oh, are we ready to do that interview then now? And I was like, well, we've just done it. Like, the magazine's gone. He said, no, well, like, I was just messing around with all that stuff. Should we do a proper one now? And I was like, well, no, we've sent the magazine. Like, it's gone to press. And he's like, I didn't mean any of that stuff. So, I mean, that was back in... it had to be about 2011-ish, maybe a little bit later. But yeah, so that, you know, the bipolar thing, it is a serious thing. I think, you know, I don't know enough about it to comment on a medical thing. The only thing is, I do know is it, I didn't think it had like Tourette's style thing in terms of talking about stuff and not having control over what comes out of your mouth.
No, I'm only repeating really what I've been told and what I heard on TalkSport this week, when Frank Warren came on and spoke to the station the following morning, when he said, you know, it's all very well being critical of Tyson, but you have to realize that these mental issues are there and that they don't go away. You know, once you are bipolar, you will always be bipolar. And that's what he was suggesting. And that's, well, excuse isn't the right word, but I think he was saying that you need to know this to understand the guy.
Yeah, and it's very hard, isn't it? When people talk about the 100 millions and all the rest of it, you instantly lose a veil of sympathy for someone, which it doesn't fix anything, does it? You can have all the money in the bank, I'd imagine, and it still doesn't, you know, as Claude Abrams used to tell me, former editor of Boxing News, happiness is an inside job. It doesn't matter where you are in the world or necessarily what's in the bank, but if you're miserable, you're miserable. And if you're not happy, then it's a serious issue, and it's struggling for that contentment. And the strange thing is, obviously, when Tyson's on, he's on fire, he's Captain Charisma, and he's the bee's knees, and people aren't, and what they don't see him in the lowest ebbs, because he's probably crying on the beach in Morecambe, you know, depressed and down, and we will never see that. So it's such a departure from what we're used to seeing that maybe people can't get their heads around what the other side is like.
Well, if people don't have a knowledge of mental illness and depression, you know, I mean, I've come across that with people very close to me in my life. And, you know, you cannot disregard the effect it has on them as human beings. And as I said before, you know, once you have those sort of problems, they never go away. Those around you have to understand and help you through, but the problem in itself never gets cured.
Ian, and I suppose the other thing as well is when you look at this, people will think, well, what's a, and this isn't me downplaying it, but what's a little mental health issue when Usyk's country's at war? You know, people weigh things up with different degrees of difficulties. I know we're all facing our own battles, but again, with everything that Usyk's been through, it kind of, you know, the Fury thing, it's I think there's less sympathy for him, certainly, than there was a few years ago.
I mean, I think it's hard to make comparisons between those two things, and everything I said before there. I mean, of course, I've got total sympathy for any problems that Tyson Fury has caused by his bipolar condition, which I wasn't aware of until I heard about it on Talk Sport this week, just like John. So, sympathies go out to Tyson Fury on that front if it's caused him problems in his life. I mean, as for, Usyk, I think it is a huge motivating factor for him that he is the torchbearer for his nation, at the feeling that he can bring at least some happiness to people back home by performing in the way that he does. And in a way, that's kind of a wonderful thing. But I didn't really like Tyson Fury saying afterwards, well, I thought I won the fight. And he kind of insinuated that the judges had been weighed by the fact that Ukraine are at war and they were leaning towards Usyk for that reason. That's what he appeared to be saying.
Well, I think that's where the bipolar things come up, because people leapt on those comments, and I think that's where Frank intervened. By the way, you know, just to digress a little bit, when we talked about Fury and fame there, Ian, where's the most awkward place you've been asked for a selfie with someone?
The most awkward place I've been asked?
Yeah.
I can't think of anywhere awkward. It doesn't happen very often. It happens once in a blue moon, if I'm honest with you.
Does it?
Because people only hear you, really, don't they? We're commentators. Same with John. I mean, maybe a little bit more. When I went to fights in Vegas, because we used to do those countdown shows around the big fights, and I did quite a bit in Vision around that time, so people did start recognizing me around, you know, especially the Hatton fight. And I was thinking, and I've hung around with people who are properly famous, like Ricky Hatton, like, you know, in football, Michael Owen, Rio Ferdinand, Steven Gerrard. You know, I've been in, you know, out with them in places, and it's really amazing to watch just how often people are coming up to them every 10 seconds to have a selfie or sign something, and their patience is quite remarkable. And I'm thinking, what must it be like for this to be your life the whole time? No wonder they go out to private places that nobody knows about. So, yeah, that is the other side of it. I mean, I suppose fame is a lovely thing, but it does have that downside. I'm happily, I can live my life in complete anonymity most of the time. So, you know, nowhere awkward that I can think of, Tris. What about you?
How about you, John? When was your last selfie with a fan?
Well, you get them occasionally at ringside, people coming round and saying, you know, can I? But I mean, the guys who talk to us and ask them are usually real fans. and they're very polite in the way that they do it. And I've never been, you know, I've never been hassled when I've been out for dinner, but I've seen it happen with other people. And yeah, as Ian says, it can be fairly you wonder about how they keep their patience. I mean, most of them are absolutely great. Ricky being one of them is always terrific with his fans, and that was whatever the problems that he might have been storing up inside. You know, one of the reasons he was so amazingly popular was that everybody who met him and talked to him came away thinking, oh, he remembered me. You know, I've had a photograph with my friend Ricky. But it's not everybody who can do that. And I can kind of understand why fighters get hacked off about it and get fed up.
Tell you what, I've just thought of the funniest thing that happened. I was at the O2 Arena after the fight one night, walking back down that aisle towards where the TV trucks were. And this guy stopped me and said, oh, can you sign this for me? And he's saying, oh, my wife loves you. She said, my wife's told me she'd marry you. And I'm trying to be deprecating. I said, well, she's a bad judge. And I suddenly thought, well, she married him. It's funny. We both burst out laughing. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. But I said, that's very nice of her.
You could have said she needs some glasses.
It was funny. Dear.
Good stuff. All right, then, gents. Well, look. I think let's put a bow on this. So rematch is coming for October. John, if you're a bookmaker, who do you make the favourite and what kind of odds are you giving out?
I'd have Usyk 6-4 on. Tyson Fury 7-4. That would be where I'd put the book. I've no idea. I've not looked. I've no idea where the bookies are putting it, but I'd have it in that sort of region. I think Usyk's done enough to be viewed as a firm favourite, but you can't disregard the attributes of Tyson Fury. And you know, I personally think that the likelihood is that Usyk would win more easily than first time around, but I still think it's a very competitive fight.
Yeah, and you're never sure how the judges are going to score it, are you?
No.
There's always that murky feeling in the background around these things. Then you could end up with a third fight. So I think your odds are about right there. Maybe Usyk even 7-4 on, having won, well, I think quite clearly the first time round. But yeah, it will be fascinating. I would look forward to seeing it again. I think there's still enough doubt and enough jeopardy for it to be a very viable second fight.
Goodness me. Well, you think of where Tyson Fury came back at the start of all this comeback, when he was 30 stone before the Seferi fight, to where he is now. The comeback now, to come back from this defeat, it's nothing like as much as what he's already had to endure and confront to turn things around now. You know, he would have been far longer odds back then to have probably even got down to under 20 stone. But the odds of him winning against Usyk in a rematch would be far shorter than what he's achieved so far. So for that reason, I couldn't put it past him, even if I would favour Usyk again. But like you, Ian, I mean, you know, when you look at the success of what this potentially was, in terms of the eyeballs on it and the talk and the chatter about it, you could easily see that this could become a trilogy.
Yep, for sure.
Sure.
So, yeah, and I'd say, do you know what? We tinkered with the idea of the draw as well, didn't we? We were 1 point out of a draw, that last scorecard.
Well, you said draw, and I was thinking as the third scorecard came up and they said 114, I'm thinking it's a draw, and I forgot because the knock had to be factored into that. But you were right, that was about 14-1. And I think, you know, my forecast was Usyk on points, and I wondered if he might even stop him late, and he nearly did. So I'm going to put one feather in my cap for that one.
I think we just got to cover all the bases next time, haven't we?
We got it right. I mean, John said Usyk as well. Usyk on points. So we got it right. So Ringside Rewind, buy it now.
Oh, dear. I can't beat that for a finale. Gents, it's been a lot of fun, as always. And I'm pleased that we've just had such a good fight to discuss and break down and talk about because, you know, we've had our share of damp squibs and despite that one scorecard, there wasn't a whole lot of controversy. We just had a great night and a great fight. And, you know, we talked about all of the other things surrounding the fight previously. And I just think, you know, for the sport to emerge without that controversy from one of those nights where all the casual fans jump on the bandwagon and want to enjoy it and they pay to enjoy it, it's just nice for once that we haven't given ourselves a black eye.
Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. You've been listening to Ringside Rewind, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.